Good afternoon, everybody. Here I am in the Temple of Silence. It's really a beautiful little place that Tuya has created over the years. I wish more of you could be here in person and participate in person with us. However, I'm also aware that we're living in very unusual circumstances. And in the same way that the Tibetan has been extremely influential in our lives, and yet, I would say for most of us, probably all of us, he has not exactly walked into the room in person. So this is a new era, and we're learning how to be alone and yet not alone. This is one of the results of the COVID epidemic, pandemic, really, because we are all in the same boat, and we are all on spaceship Earth, as it were. There's so much yet to accomplish, which is in line with the divine plan, which over the many millennia and even millions of years has not been accomplished. The raising up of a human being is, from our perspective, a lengthy matter. And, you know, maybe it takes, on the average, 25 million years. That would be a Ray 4 number, and we're talking about the fourth kingdom in nature and the fourth creative hierarchy. Maybe it takes that long from the time animal man becomes individualized and enters into that state of awareness that we call the human kingdom. Well, you know, I like to segue a little bit from what we finished last time, a very long program. I know you can't listen to it and view it all in one sitting. But you'll find a way, if you are interested, to get into it and to benefit, certainly, from the Tibetan's words, and perhaps from some of the additional thoughts that I offer. The segue talks about the present era of human living, and how does that look from the Shambolic perspective? Well, in it, it says we have in it people with the Lemurian consciousness focused on the past and concerned with the physical plane are present. Perhaps they are not really the majority. Perhaps these are some of the latest of the individualizers, because there was individualization in the Atlantean period too, and not just the Lemurian period. And perhaps in addition, the bulk of those who individualized in Lemuria have reached the Atlantean consciousness, emotional in content and focused on the present, are everywhere to be found, and that present is largely illusory and largely glamour-filled and largely personal, although there are always those who make more rapid progress. And then people who are definitely Aryan in their state of awareness, mentally focused and occupied with the future, they are likewise to be found, and it is probable that most of DK's disciples are of this type, and it is probable even that most of them came from the moon chain, and maybe some from the previous solar system, previous major solar system. There have been, and this is the fifth, there have been five solar systems up to this point, but only the one preceding and this one have been considered major solar systems, and the next one with the personality array of the solar logos, I would say, being the first ray, will also be major. So here we are on program 11, and we've given a lot of attention to this stage of little chelaship, which is associated, we have learned, with the first initiation. And by that, we mean the birth of the Christ in the heart. It's sometimes confusing, you know, we say first initiation, first real initiation, the true initiate, and we seem to discount the two initiations of the threshold over which the Christ presides as initiator. So we have to look at the context carefully and see whether the Tibetan does mean the first of the probationary initiations, which is the birth of the Christ in the heart, so connected with what? Gemini, Virgo, Leo, Capricorn, or whether we mean the third initiation, which is the first real initiation and makes a person capable really of entering within the periphery of the ashram. So every time the numbering of the initiations is given, we have to study the context and see what is the most likely meaning. That's, of course, one of the ways that Master DK has of blinding and giving hints we have to know what the numbers mean. Well, that all took place in part four, and now we have a rather lengthy section. I don't know how far I'll get today, and today is the 7th of June. And I must say, what is so lovely, what is so rare as a day in June? And even up here in the far north, the weather has changed. Of course, the thunderstorms will be coming, and sometimes pretty violent, but the June weather is superb. No more excuses for not getting out there and trying to walk a bit. Well, here we go with the second stage of discipleship, the chela in the light. To be a chela is to be a serious student. Not just someone who may be a little curious. A chela is a committed student, and one who is somehow determined to follow through according to the advice of the teacher, and no matter what. And hopefully we have that no matter what as a theme within our psyche. It isn't always that such opportunities as are now offered are offered. It's not always, but this is a very critical time, and the present hierarchy is building towards the possibility of producing even more fifth degree initiates will be needed in the future age. And the speed of our attainment has very much to do with our willingness to sacrifice, willingness to think in terms of the group, and not only in terms of our own personal welfare. I think I seem to recall DK saying that when we do think in terms of the larger whole and of the group, our personal needs will be taken care of. So this is a stage in which I think, at least, the majority of today's disciples the majority of today's disciples will be found. And the 50-some students that DK took under his wing, and later quite a number of them were seen as accepted disciples, I think the majority belonged in this category until the master accepted them And there were these 4 points of presage or preface that had to be achieved. We've studied them before the master could really make that link and say, okay, now I accept you as my disciple. A very great responsibility, and we have been looking at all this from the master's point of view. So this stage is definitely one, DK says, in which the consciousness of the probationer is occupied with the overcoming of glamour and the curing of the distorted, myopic vision of the man who has been immersed in the life of matter or form. The overcoming of glamour. Now, you know, it's going to take place somehow between the first and second initiations, because even the stage of accepted discipleship often will occur before the second initiation occurs. Now, truthfully, so many of us are involved in the overcoming of glamour, and we have a very, you know, short range vision of things, and we have been immersed in the life of matter form, and probably still are to a degree that we don't recognize. So a lot of things that DK is going to say here are going to look familiar to us. It doesn't mean that as an accepted disciple, glamour is completely overcome or illusion, no. But there's a great deal of dealing with it during this stage of Chela in the light. I suppose in the light of the soul, particularly, being aware of the light of the soul, and less focused on the outer personality. He is now attempting to see the new vision, to control the world of emotional reactions, and to work in a new medium, that of light. So what do we have here? The light worker. You know, that's a pretty popular term these days. People refer to themselves as light workers, whether they have a full idea of what that really means, but they are sending light, feeling the impression of light, transmitting, they think, the light of the soul. So these are the light workers. Of course, the master and higher initiates are also light workers, but on a much higher turn of the spiral. So beyond little chelaship and the aspiration which forces the light to shine forth, as we have read, here is the probationary disciple seeking to work in the light which has shone forth. And remember that this type of human being is still the probationer until there is reached the stage of accepted discipleship. In a way, everything before the acceptance by the master, you know, you go through your accepting stage, you go through your pledge, and you seek to meditate, study, and serve and aspire. Okay, that may be even after the first initiation, and still, in a way, in relation to the stage of accepted discipleship, you are a probationer. You're being tested out. You're being put to the test. That's what being a probationer is all about. It's not like we take the first initiation and suddenly we're no longer a probationer. It's true, we are a more sincere and committed disciple, and we are also an initiate of the, probationary initiate, I guess you might say, an initiate of the threshold. Yes, true. But at the same time, you're still being put to the test. And, you know, if you feel you have passed this stage and are an accepted disciple, you have to keep your eyes open for others who are being tested out. There is no complete standardization of these steps through which we must pass. It's not always the same. And over the millions of years of our evolution, we've gone through many different phases, which are in contrast to the phases through which others have passed. So we have to be aware of the distinctions and not look for anything that is totally rigid. And yet at the same time, we have to be able to identify more or less the stage in which we find ourselves. So he's trying to see a new vision. Alice Bailey, of course, was under the influence of the Tibetan's dictation, was always seeing a new vision. But she was on a much higher turn of the spiral. She talked about the great vistas which unfolded before her, as the Tibetan might be talking about one thing, but it seemed to connect with something maybe even greater that he wasn't talking about. So that's the way it works. At new points of tension, we see new visions. And even though we sustain a particular higher point of tension, a yet higher vista may appear to us. And notice here the connection with subduing the normal glamorous emotional reactions. Now, maybe we will also begin to see light as substance and being the foundation of that which is revealed. Okay. The masters do not work upon the astral plane. Certain schools of occultism teach that they do, but such is not the case. For them, having overcome glamour and illusion, the astral plane is non-existent. Well, at least, you know, what I tend to think about this, it is not the matter of the so-called astral plane, which is non-existent, but the unstable, illusory forms. We do need that matter to make the bridge between the etheric and the mental plane. And if the magician is deprived of that matter, he dies. So it's more what is created within that field of matter that is non-existent for the master in its usual form. Anyway, DK always repeats this, that for the great ones, the astral plane is non-existent, then how would they be working with those forms? But I think we have to try to understand more deeply that there is a continuity of atomic life, from the very lowest plane to the highest, from the highest to the lowest. And that no plane or subplane is devoid of the appropriate type of matter. At least that's how I interpret it. It's non-existent. It is but an illusory concept of the camomanastic type of mind, the mind of the average aspirant. Well, that is, of course, interesting, that the average aspirant has the camomanastic mind. We notice that whereas Mercury may be connected with Manus in a pure form, Venus is connected with Camomanus, and on a much higher turn of the spiral and cosmically, there's something about the Sirian system, which is also related to Camomanus. So we do have work upon the astral plane, and it is how the master inspires us in our soul nature that facilitates our doing of that work. What does the astral plane look like to them? You know, it is a material range of vibration, but they're certainly not concerned about the forms there found, the forms into which matter is molded. They point those things out so that we can deal with them, but they work on higher levels. So anyway, I'll just kind of bring this into focus. The chela is, therefore, at this stage, guarded and guided by someone who is still subject to glamour. Now, what status does that indicate? Well, are there glamours beyond the third degree? I suppose there are some big fundamental ones, but this could be a disembodied chela, probably disembodied and approaching the third initiation, but is at the same time aware of the ephemeral nature of the astral plane, namely that the forms built of astral matter are consistently changing. And he is not to become attached to those forms. If possible. Guarded and guided by someone who is still subject to glamour. The trouble with dealing with glamour is that it is elusive. So many of us are subject to it, but we don't realize we are. And when Master DK comes along and studies us and writes letters and so forth, and may point out a significant glamour in our life, we may be quite surprised, because after all, it's our ordinary way of doing things. And it's so habitual as to have become natural and therefore accepted as a way of being, a reasonable way of being. So we have to really be very responsive to his indications, to detect one's glamours, and let us assume that all of us have them at this time, is no easy matter. No easy matter. Just pause for a minute and think about the way you're living this incarnation. And what glamours there may be that have been brought over from the past, or have seemingly arisen in this incarnation. Around page 120 in the glamour book, he gives the list of individual glamours. I will say that there is one glamour that is just huge, and it has kind of a lunar cause, and it probably can be found as an element in the many others, and that is the glamour of fear. Fear. when we can be truly fearless, as probably the Spirit is, the Spirit within us, the Spirit that is us, we're coming a long way toward the overcoming of glamour. And we can't merely pretend to be fearless. It has to be something that is real, anchored within us. And our fearlessness grows with the experience. Let's suppose that someone is afraid to die. Fear of death is a big prevailing kind of glamour, and yet somehow succeeds in moving in and out of the body at will. As one can do, I think, when the sixth petal of the egoic lotus is unfolded. Well, it becomes such a customary activity without dire consequences that one realizes that that fear based upon losing the body and losing all connection with what is valued and cherished, that that fear is baseless, because we move in and out and we have the ability to do so at will, and we the next world becomes familiar, and you're not going to be extinguished or anything like that. As the Tibetan says, there is no death. So with those repeated experiences, fear subsides. Okay. This stage involves so many aspirants in the world today, you know, those who have taken the first initiation, that before I proceed with other matters, I would like to touch upon the nature of the work which the masters are seeking to do with their groups of disciples in this hour of crisis. Now, this is where the bulk of the disciples are found. So many aspirants, so many true aspirants, because this stage does not occur until after the first initiation. What are the masters attempting to do? One day, such a responsibility, albeit in a different context, will be ours. We will be the master, with the duty of inspiring a group of aspirants and disciples. And we're not really going to run out of world crises. Whenever there is the possibility of great change, as there is now in relation to the forthcoming Aquarian age, there will be crisis, there will be critical decisions. Okay, so this is a matter of profound importance to the world from the angle of the masters themselves. Never forget that in all our discussions and in all your effort to understand, I am endeavoring to decentralize you. You know, that's the sort of the fourth D, you might say, discipline, dispassion, discrimination, decentralization, making us less personality fixated. I'm endeavoring to decentralize you because I guess the average lower ego-focused student is centralized upon himself or herself. I'm endeavoring to decentralize you by giving you, as far as I can, the point of view of the hierarchy, stepping it down until it can come within the range of comprehension of the average aspirant. And he tells us, look, do consider yourself to be the average aspirant, the average disciple. Otherwise, the danger of becoming egotistical and thus separate from all others, and thus filled with pride and separativeness and cruelty, that danger is real. So we should now and then analyze how well we have proceeded with our decentralization. You know, the average mother or father in the family has just the circumstances needed to promote decentralization. Every couple that's had a child knows that they might like to sleep through the night, but they can't because the child has a demand and they have to think of the child first. It's a bit like the solar angel having its own affairs to attend to, but the personality is crying out, and one has to attend wisely, of course, to the need that is being expressed. So this is something to keep in mind as a real achievement. Decentralization. Who's the most important of all? Well, it's not, as we say, number one. It has to do with the plan and with those whom the plan serves. And finally, with those who serve the plan, in that order. It all boils down to the question of the degree of selfishness, which is a very limited focus. The degree of selfishness we've been able to overcome. Maybe not until the second degree, when Mars begins to be put in place, do we really begin to overcome that selfishness? And at the third degree, the divine will under Vulcan definitely kills Abel, the shepherd. And the symbol of that kind of Aretian selfishness, which is simply considered natural at first, you know, the old saying, you have to look out for number one. Well, you have to keep your instrument in good shape, but your greatest concern cannot be the emotional, psychological happiness of number one. So DK is trying to give us the point of view of hierarchy, which is something that we would not, without his help, appreciate. We can appreciate our own point of view. But if we use the analogies of parenthood, so often the parent has to do what he or she doesn't want to do. Waking up, changing diapers in the middle of the night, and all of that. Sleep interrupted and or other activities interrupted. It's how things are put together. It's necessary. There's no escape from it. If one wants to do his duty. Going on then. As far as these aspirants are concerned, the one thing the masters are endeavoring to bring about is the stimulation of the flame of the spirit in them so that they may set the world on fire. Well, it's not going to be the fires of hatred and separation. It's not going to be fires by friction. It's going to be a different kind of fire. The fire of the will to love, the fire of love. Fire is, in a way, simply an increase of activity, which results in a purification and even destruction of that which it touches. So the flame of spirit seems a long way from us, but it is absolutely fundamental to everything we are, and the triad is spirit, the soul is spirit, the personality is spirit. Everything that hangs from the flame, even though the form appears distinct and peculiar and particulate, all that is really the projection of the spirit, which is what I am. The fires of judgment and of substance, of karma and its vehicle, matter, certain arrangements of matter stage the possibility of the enactment of karma. These fires are raging in the world at this time. Judgment, whether good or for ill. And the underlying atomic structure, underlying the next most outward demonstration. Substance is always causative to phenomena which we are more likely to notice. The fires of karma and its vehicle, matter, are raging in the world at this time. Fire must be countered by fire. Fight fire with fire. And even we have this in our fire departments now, the so-called controlled burn, which prevents the spread of the kind of burning that was out of control. Fire must be countered by fire, as well you know. And to stop the raging inferno of fire, which is today devastating the world, and this is wartime, the fire of spirit must be opposed, distributed, and effectively used by the disciples of the Master. Spirit holds the answer. Spirit holds the key. But it's not so easy. Even though spirit is active within us, even at the time of the first initiation, and really always, it's not so easy to consciously contact it. So this kind of Armageddon, many people have thought of the Second World War as the Armageddon, has brought fire and the devastation of that which is past and present. He uses words that are not mild, words like raging, inferno, devastating. Humanity is on the burning ground. And that surely means that a much better future is going to be possible. Because what is burned away has been obstructive. And although it's painful to the personality, the purification by fire must occur. Really, when you look at it, one of the ways of describing reality is as fire. Of course, I tend to like the word being more so, because the being of anything, well, let's just say fire, water, air, the elements, they all arise, those qualities all arise from pure being. But there are different fires, and as students of esotericism, we are going to encounter those fires. The task of Shambhala in relation to hierarchy is similar in nature, but expresses itself upon a higher level. I mean, we're having to think here of the hierarchy as containing, relative to Shambhala, some impurities which have to be burned away. So we are treading the path of purification, and if we're really treading the path, the purification will occur. So hierarchy's relationship to Shambhala is similar. Now, Shambhala, what does it do? It dispenses the ultimate fire of the will, the fire which must, in the final analysis, be used by the disciples in the world is the fire of the will to love. Sometimes we don't see how we will get through these dire circumstances preserved by our own ignorance. How will we get through them? But we do, we are, we do contain, and we are the fire of spirit. And that holds every possibility of countering the lesser fires. Different fires have different ranges, we might say. Fire by friction has a certain range. Solar fire, a larger permeating range, and the fire of spirit, the greatest range of all, because not only is it in everything, but in a way it is everything. So we are being trained to recognize the fire of the will, and most important, is at least the will to love. The fire is not what you think it is. The will to love means the love of the greater whole and the ability to do that which is needed for the good of the group in the right way and with the needed skill and action, and I might say, which includes the right timing. So we have the definitions of fire, clarifications of what this really is. Some of us look at a campfire and say, well, that's fire. But there are other kinds of fire which do not have that kind of appearance at all and cause dramatic changes in that which it touches. So the fire, here we have the fire of the will to love, is not what we think it is. The will to love means the love of the greater whole. And the ability to do that which is needed for the good of the group in the right way and with the needed skill in action. Okay. It involves capacity for firm action where need arises, because the disciple has long-range vision and is not misled by the immediate perspective, which is, what did DK say, the point of illusion. He works and prepares for the future. This fire, it is, in other words, the loving intention to fire the entire world with the new idea of the spirit of relationship. That's the second aspect, quality. Beginning with the disciple's own self, his family and immediate group, this is the will to fire. It would be well to reflect deeply on these ideas to bring about and render effective this fiery stimulation, to bring about and render effective this fiery stimulation, the disciple must apply the fire to himself, and in the ensuing blaze, see himself as he truly is. The fire of the material aspect, the fire, the change agent, we can call fire that, the fire of the personality is still too prevalent and too powerful in the lives of aspirants. It renders them harmful. And in the esoteric healing book, the discussion of harmlessness, is very important. A sense of proportion, right sense of proportion, a completed point of view, and divine understanding. These are the ingredients of harmlessness rather than harmfulness. I would remind you that the fire of the mental plane, that means of the mind, is the reflection and distorted reflection of the fire of spirit. We remember there is a special connection of the fire of the monad and its ray with the fire of mind and its ray. Some disciples use only the fire of the mind. And we have all met such people, and maybe as we've made progress, we have learned to use the fire of the will to love, even the fire of love. In their highest and best moments, they attempt to use the fire of love to offset the fires of the critical mind, but at the best, it is no spontaneous flow. but a laborious effort to be nice, to refrain through drastic disciplining of themselves, because that criticism is so ingrained in them that dire creator of misery, as the Tibetan calls it, they through laborious effort, they attempt to refrain from uttering the things which their critical minds say, or to act upon the opinions they may have formed through the use of the fire of mind. This fire is always directed at a brother, and the effort to refrain from the use of this fire inevitably creates a gap or barrier among the majority of aspirants. This is quite a statement. There is no true love in action, but only much personality effort to be non-critical. So he's basically telling us that in our groups, love in action, goodwill, is not really flowing. But at least we may discipline ourselves to be apparently non-critical, though our critical mind interiorly does speak. Their concentration is upon the recognized and basic need to be non-critical, because it is right so to be. And there is a reward for those who achieve it. But the concentration is not based on the effects upon others when the fire of mind is let loose with its destroying, burning, and damaging effects. It's quite an assessment of us and our seeming inability spontaneously to love. Oh, that's a long paragraph. So here is the will to love. And at least maybe that can be developed if we think holistically, if there are no barriers to where we pervade, to where we find ourselves. It's a peculiar realization, but it can come upon us if we are properly decentralized and if we know a little bit of the meaning of infusception, or whatever you want to call it in your own language. The disciple is working for the future. And he has the loving intention to fire the entire world with the new idea of the spirit of relationship beginning with the disciple's own self and his immediate group. How do we treat each other now? Just look at some of the deliberative bodies, such as the Senate, the House of Representatives, and their parallels in various countries. Is the spirit of relationship really there? Or presumably with a lot of first-rate souls in that group, is the spirit of the acquisition of power, no matter what, there found? So this is a very somehow important contrast between the use of the fire of mind and the use of the fire of the will to love, followed actually by the fire of love. So sometimes the Bailey students are criticized by others and say, look, you tend to use only the mind. Some disciples use only the fire of mind. And Bailey students, at least those who are beginning, may fall into that trap. But we have to realize what a loving individual the Tibetan is, wisely loving, wisdom and love, love, wisdom, and somehow offers us the opportunity to use the fire of love to offset the fires of the critical mind. But it's not yet a flowing, spontaneous process. It's tedious because something comes to your tongue and you could say it, and then you have to stifle it because you know it's not right to say it. You know that, but it's not yet a spontaneous process. So I think we hurt each other quite a bit through the fires of the critical mind. And I'm just going to put that down. We hurt each other quite a bit through the directing of the fires of the critical mind. And let's remember that criticism is one of the great causes of glamour, along with self-pity and along with suspicion. Today's suspicion is rife because people do not recognize what's within them and what they are projecting upon others. They have a kind of knowledge, rather vague, but sufficient, of what is within them. And they suspect that what they are influenced by is really in the other person. So a lot of psychological work has to be done. before it is possible to drop this suspicion and to see, discern the good in others. Okay. The masters are therefore, I guess we've read these sentences many times because they are excised in the Arcane School literature as important statements. The masters are therefore anxious to burn up the disciple in the fire of the will to love, so that he is set free and the barriers to the inflow of the avataric force, let's call it the force of the Christ, may be dissolved. Burn up the disciple in the fire of the will to love. And going further, of course, if we can get beyond the will to love, which is a necessary stage, there is love itself. Burn up the disciple in the fire of love. So the disciple will be set free, and the barriers to the inflow of the avataric force may be dissolved. Whether this is through the technique of light or through the technique of the presence, there is a deformulation, a destructuring of the forms in which, on various levels, matter is trapped. And those forms themselves are trapping us from true reception by the avatar. Why is this? And then, you know, the hard sayings. Why are the masters anxious to burn the disciple in the fires of the will to love? Because it is the disciples of the world and not the mass of men who today hinder the coming of the avatar and render useless his intention. So a heavy responsibility lies upon us because of our mostly unconscious obstructiveness. We disciples he dare not come. Until the disciples and aspirants in the world bring about the needed changes in themselves, it would be a disaster, the kind of stimulation he would offer of the seeds of obstruction and evil still within the aspirants and disciples. So he dare not come until the disciples and aspirants in the world bring about the needed changes in themselves, for the reason that there would not be enough of the will to love with the fiery essence, to balance the tremendous energy he would bring. So the moment for the reappearance of the Christ, the avatar, is up to him. He will see when there is enough of the will to love with the fiery essence. And not before. So we can't say somehow, look, in the year 2125, the Christ will appear. It's a conditional matter. It depends on what we do to prepare ourselves, our groups, and our nations, and humanity as a whole for his arrival. And that's why we've had some people running around lately saying, lo here, lo there, here he is in East London. He's waiting for the press to discover him. And then, you know, it's foolish, but pictures of him begin to appear, and they don't show any of the radiation of the Christ, but they do capture the gullible. And let us not be numbered among them. Let us not be numbered among the gullible who look for the Christ ahead of time without having fulfilled the requirements in the major planetary centers. DK pretty well gives it to us in the externalization of the hierarchy. How much work has to be done before the Christ can really appear? And we're all familiar with the idea that a measure of sharing must govern national and international relations. A measure of peace must govern also, because we are a warring kingdom. And there's just too much war and too much antagonism between us. And then, of course, and it is happening, I think, first in the field of religion, and then I would say in the field of politics, the house cleaning in the field of religion and politics. So do we see how Master DK, for all of the extraordinarily factual information that he's giving us, is encouraging us to love first to be guided by the will to love with the fiery essence, and then to be guided by actually love itself. That is what he is doing. This particular program, I am being called away, so it will be a bit shorter. I can't leave it, otherwise it may collapse. I'll just say a few more things and then continue later. So where this will to love with the fiery essence is present, two things can take place. Number one, there can be the needed stepping down of the inflowing energy of the avatar, which the inflowing energy of the avatar would bring with him, so that it can be effective in humanity. Otherwise, this avataric energy cannot really reach those it must reach. And number two, the avatar and those who are working with him, now I guess that would involve his masters and certainly the triangle surrounding him of the avatar of synthesis, the spirit of peace, and the Buddha. We're considering here maybe Christ to be the avatar. The avatar and those who are working with him and under his influence can be provided with a group which can do what? Respond intelligently to the influence, recognizing it and absorbing it. This is hardly yet the case, and so much of what passes for Christianity is not that at all, and is some concrete-minded, rigid belief system. And this group can distribute the inflowing energy, which humanity sorely needs. And point C, interpret to humanity the new impelling forces which are occupied with the precipitation of the new vision, the new world order, and the new ideals. Humanity at present remains in ignorance about these things. So it is necessary that there be sufficient of this will to love with the fiery essence. And then these beneficent developments can occur. The needed stepping down of the inflowing energy. That's number one. And a group, the avatar is provided with a group that can do useful, beneficent things. Responding intelligently to the avataric influence. As I said, it's hardly yet the case. so much of what Christ intends to bring has been distorted. And is even against the very thing that he would see happen. Distribute the inflowing energy, which is hardly the case yet, only in small pockets here and there, and among the world servers is this energy distributed, and interpret, explain the new impelling forces so that there can be right understanding. And so we have certainly our work cut out for us, and we have to be cognizant of and capable of wielding, expressing this will to love with the fiery essence, even though we may not yet totally express pure love. That comes next. So these are desirable results. Desirable results. Okay, friends, I have not wanted to leave at this point, but I find that I must. So hopefully when I get back, I will be able to continue. And let's see where we are here. We began on page 719, and I think we made it as far as 721. 721. Okay. So I'll make a note of that. 719 to 721. I certainly wish it were faster, but you know, I'm going along attempting to understand, just as I hope to have you understand more deeply. And it's always possible to understand more deeply. That I am certainly learning as I consider once again these important matters. You wonder when it might be possible not to have to read all this again, but no, even in the future, it will be necessary. So this is the end of Program 11, and basically we're just a couple of pages, and we'll begin, hopefully, when I return from my errand, with Program number 12. And hopefully on this same day, we'll begin with the idea that there will then be very many chelas in the light, and on the other graded steps of discipleship. So Master DK and his fellow masters are looking for a real unfoldment of the capability of those who are now aspirants. They will take things more seriously and be more useful. Okay, friends, this is going to be a odd timing on this program, but so be it, and I'll be back to you a little bit later.